Side to side, my senses slide, avoiding my commands. One by one, they come undone. I fall into your hands.
Hey everyone, this is the Helping Friendly Podcast. This is RJ. I'm here with Brad and Jonathan, and we're here with Tom Marshall, who has graciously agreed to appear and kind of walk us through a lot of questions that we have for him. And he's going to enlighten us with all kinds of awesome stories and knowledge and background. I met Tom at the Man shows in June of this year, late June, and we started talking, and it turns out that Tom had an awesome podcast idea in the works, which will be launching in the coming weeks when you hear this. It's called Under the Scales, and it's a really awesome project, and we've been sort of chatting with Tom behind the scenes about it, but just want to introduce Tom and have him talk a little bit about this venture that he's undertaking.
Hey everyone, this is RJ. I just wanted to interject quickly before Tom talks about Under the Scales. When we recorded this, you heard me say that Under the Scales would be coming in the coming weeks. We didn't know exactly when it would come out at that point. That was in early September, but just so everyone knows, it will be coming out on Monday, November 7th, so 3 days after you hear this. You'll be able to listen to Under the Scales. Throw it back to the recording so you can hear Tom describe the project.
Hey guys. Well, first of all, hi Brad. I haven't met you yet, but I've met Jonathan and obviously RJ. How you doing?
Thanks, Tom.
Oh, so happy to be here. And yeah, I was going to say it's me that should be thanking you. You guys have been extremely helpful in a new guy trying to get a podcast off the ground, and I'm really excited about it. But I'm more than happy to come on yours after all the help you guys have given me.
They're going to be complimentary, and I think that's really exciting.
I think it's important to, for the record, right now, let's just establish a treaty of cooperation.
Perfect. Sounds good.
I ain't signing shit.
Brad's a lawyer. He knows better. Well, Tom, can you tell us a little bit about Under the Scales, sort of the inspiration, what it's going to be, and how you came to start the venture?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it really came about just from being a fish fan for 30 plus years. And when you talk to friends over the years, it's apparent that everybody has a story about fish, whether it's how they discovered it or some other adventure or misadventure they had, or just an amazing experience at a show, etc. Plus the band and the band insiders, everybody has a story, and it's an undocumented history. And so I thought I could be part of bringing that history to life. And I really want to involve the fans as well. So for every podcast that I give, I'm also going to, at the end of it, appeal to everyone during every show to send in stories. And if they're cool, I'd like to interview them as well. So people I've talked to already have started a marijuana business, an entertainment company, other bands. It's incredible what the fans are up to. And I'd like to bring that to life in the context of fish. So even fish food and Ben and Jerry's would be fair game, you know, because Trey and I stood in line at the very first Ben and Jerry's where either Ben or Jerry served us free ice cream on their first day.
That is awesome. I think what we're going to continue to do at HF Pod is to continue to bring you sort of the in-depth discussions of sets and music and analyzing jams and talking to people about, you know, chord progressions and minor and major. And I think Tom's going to stay sort of above that fray and talk more about the experiences and the culture.
It's a good way of making a distinction right away is that, yeah, people will learn about me. I'm not a set list guy. I don't like too much going backwards, going forwards in terms of, you know, writing songs, but also listening. But, you know, of course, fish is 99% of what's, you know, in my phone. So I listen, but I don't sort of listen and know, oh yeah, that was March 21st, 1998. You know what I mean?
Great show.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
So I think it's great because one of the things that I've taken from growing old with fish or adulting with fish is all of us are now professionals or at least have careers or have children or families and are doing other things other than going on tour and going to high school or college or whatever we did when we first started. So I think it's really interesting, Tom.
Awesome.
So Tom, thanks again for joining us to sort of, I think a lot of our fans were excited to hear you answer some questions. Some of these are fan questions. Some of them are ours. And I think all of them are going to be interesting to our listeners. So we'll just dive in. I guess one thing, and I think this, I'll quote the question we put together is, at what point did you realize, like, holy shit, this is actually a thing in terms of song, you know, songwriting and partnering with Trey, as opposed to just like, this is just a thing I do with my friend?
I could sort of trace it to one moment, and that's probably, although I want to say I'm still always just, you know, keeping up, we're trying to always keep that vibe of just writing songs with my friend. That's like one of the big things, defining ways of that Trey and I sort of describe our relationship, is that we're still having fun writing songs, and we're going to do it, you know, whether there's a fish or not. I remember at 23 East in Ardmore, PA, and this was 1989. Trey in his car, because they drove their own cars back then to gigs, had me come, you know, into his car before the show, and he played me this rough mix of Lawn Boy, the album Lawn Boy. And I remember thinking, oh my God, this is sort of like a real sounding album. And he played me, my three songs on there are Lawn Boy, Squirming Coil, and Bouncing Around the Room. And I remember thinking, like, with a little bit of work, I could have, you know, improved the songs a bit. And I started thinking a little bit more about the craft and getting songs on albums. That sort of became a thing for me where it wasn't before. Working more directly with Trey. The timing there also happened to be right around maybe a little bit later, 91, 92, when they were playing bigger and bigger places. So it did start getting more real. But again, Trey and I are committed to keeping the same sense of humor, and that remains, and, you know, possibly a little bit different than you find in other bands.
Well, that's pretty cool. And so keeping with that, you guys, you take these like songwriting vacations, right, where you hole up in a house and, you know, the mountains or at the beach or what have you. You know, they started probably in the mid 90s. Is there like a lot of undeveloped or underdeveloped material that still exists from those previous sessions?
Right. So 97 was when we first started really organizing the songwriting trips. Okay. And there was a series of barns that that Beth Montori, Fish's longest employee, rented for us, and she would have Paul Languedoc and Pete Carini go to the farmhouses and put what became what we called Rubber Jungle, which is Trey's mobile recording studio. And we honed it over the years, and it was really Paul Languedoc who came up with the first road case of you know, some cool EQs, an ADAT, I guess, a 8-track recorder, and a cool mixing board. And then he would set up a guitar station, a bass station, a drum station, a couple vocal stations, and of course, Trey's guitars. And he would have it all mic'd and ready to go. So we could sort of press play and tweak one button on the mixer and jump to a different station. And this, of course, benefited Trey more than I, because he's the multi-instrumentalist. But every now and then I would sit down on drums and stuff and you know, create a jam and a vibe that way. But yeah, so is there a trove of undeveloped songs? Kind of. I mean, the best ones from the sessions were obvious. And there's right. always a few, though, that are on the cusp. The one that comes to mind right now, which has almost made a couple of the last album sessions, is like a Through the Looking Glass kind of lyrics, Lewis Carroll inspired. And that one actually is called Through the Polished Glass. But also a few of those songs that didn't become Fish songs made it onto my SoundCloud under Thunderburn, not Bird Burn. Right.
Nice. Listen to some of those. And Rubber Jungle, Trey used that as the name for a record label, at least for a time. I'm not sure if he's still got that. But for some of his solo project records, he used Rubber Jungle Records, I believe.
Yeah. And I think that was inspired by the studio.
Cool. And so have the sessions kind of changed? Are you guys still doing it more or less the same way when you get together, or other than maybe new tech or that kind of thing showing up?
Location.
Yeah.
Well, so there was a while where we would go to Trey's house. He had a real cool place at Palisades, and that was, you know, overlooking the Hudson River. But in terms of change, do you mean like getting older kind of stuff?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, you guys, you know, find you spend more time sitting around and drinking coffee and shooting the shit or, you know.
Well, yeah. Well,
more
definitely.
Time or?
Much more coffee, much less beer, much less tequila. Sure. No extracurricular activity, if you know what I'm talking about. but getting older is sort of a different thing, not in the sense of having to be in bed by 10 o'clock, but more what are your interests and priorities that drive you? Who are you writing for? What kind of song do you want to write? And these are things that Trey and I don't necessarily vocalize, but they're the reason a song like Joy, for example, gets written. That's about daughters and sharing the joy of having them and the joy of being dads together, you know, which created the concept. And that song can't happen really when we're in our 20s.
No, naturally. And you guys find yourselves, you say you don't talk about it, so you guys have kind of moved roughly in step with these kinds of changes, yeah. Shifts?
Yeah. I mean, we talk about it. We self-analyze, but self-analyzation is sort of often a damper on creativity. And yeah. So we right. try not to do it during a session. And then, you know, after the session's over, there's no reason to do it. So we don't really end up doing it. But it's funny that I was just talking about, like, you know, dads. And I literally was talking about dad rock. And I want to debunk the dad rock concept, but I think I might be bunking it instead.
You're responsible for Fish becoming dad rock.
Well, you know, at least
by becoming a dad.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yes, absolutely.
So many of us fans have become dads as well. So, yeah. You know, what
totally
can I
worth
say?
It.
So we might be responsible too.
Exactly. Well, okay. All of us.
The dads should like the dad rock then.
Yeah, it seems, it's natural.
You just we have to debunk that getting old is bad.
There
you
go.
Yeah. So, Tom, you mentioned earlier a little bit about that you still want to keep it fun and jovial, and you know, you guys are just get together because you enjoy each other. Do you ever hear or take personally the criticism that the lyrics aren't? I don't know how to say this, and I don't mean for it to be a heavy hitting question or anything, but one of the things I always find myself defending, you know, with Fish shows, it's just music, and then the lyrics don't make any sense. I'm like, they totally make sense. You got to listen more, and you got to be part of the scene, I guess. Do you ever find yourself defending the lyrics? Your lyrics?
Every now and then, like online, I find myself sort of, I'll peruse like a lyric thread, and you know, I'll be alternately insulted and then at the same time complimented by the next person. I kind of try to stay out of that fray. But yeah, I mean, I get it. I'm very different, I guess. You know, take whichever lyricist you want who's become semi-famous or extremely famous and put my lyrics next to them, and they're definitely a little off the wall in some cases. But no, I've gotten over it for the most part. You get a thick skin in terms of the criticism. And the thing for me is just knowing that, you know, Trey really liked my stuff, and I was writing a lot of stuff, and for whatever reason, like, it resonated with Trey. And so that was kind of who I was writing for a lot in a lot of cases.
It's all that matters, right?
it seemed to be, yeah. And you know, we really came from a, you know, writing in eighth grade together, we were trying to make our friend Aaron Wolf laugh, you know?
Yeah.
Or when Aaron and I wrote Wilson, we were trying to make Trey laugh. That was kind of the, you know, that was the goal.
That's great. That's great. And that's
and in a way that kind of stayed there.
Yeah. Trey says he still has, like, he still smiles or chuckles when he sings those first couple of lines of Wilson. So that's pretty cool.
There's others too. Yeah. Like, I sometimes cringe during Stash, and then Trey, you know, during, like, you know, a garden dependent on whales or whatever. And sometimes think, like, if I just changed one word, you know, but Trey then will tell me, are you kidding, man? Those are my favorite lyrics of all time. That kind of thing. So whenever I'm sort of cringing out there, like chalk dust torture, I forget, there's one line in there that sort of doesn't sit right with me. Trey will say, are you kidding? That's my favorite line. You know, he always does that. Mm-hmm. So.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
So you used to, if I remember correctly, used to send Trey lyrics, notebooks or what have you. I think I've read that in previous interviews. And then he would kind of select what suited what he was writing or what resonated with him. Do you guys still do any of that, you know, maybe via email or what have you? And I guess the follow-up question is, you know, there's stuff that he didn't select for whatever reason that day or that week, that month. Would you say there was a, you know, what kind of percentage of that there is there out there? And, you know, how does that, can you detach from the things that you sent him that just didn't click or?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It brings sort of two parts to me in a way. That I could answer that way in two parts. One is ownership, and this isn't really your question, but I want to talk about it because in terms of ownership of a song, Trey's always been way more generous than I always thought he needed to be about that sort of thing. He could do 99% of the work, and I could write three or four lines, and it would still be an Anastasio Marshall song. And that kind of stems from the 50% words, 50% music songwriter model thing. It's like a right. tradition, you know, if you write a great set of words and need someone to write music for you, he'll own half the song. Mm-hmm. And likewise, if you write a really great song and need some words, you go down to Nashville and get someone to write some words. Now that person owns half the song. It's just sort of a thing that happened and Trey always honored. And that also, that stems from the Beatles. The most immediate example that jumps to mind is the Beatles. Trey's my favorite band, hands down. All of Paul and John's songs are credited Lennon and McCartney. But, you know, the fans know who wrote it. Like, Martha, My Dear is 100% Paul, right? And yet, yep. Ballad of John and Yoko is about John, you know, running around Europe trying to get married or get a marriage license with Yoko and encountering that, you know, that adventure and encountering various, you know, misadventures along the way. It's pure John. And yet it's incredible that you look at those and they're Lennon McCartney. The cool thing about that song for me has always been that John showed up at the studio after that whole debacle. And, if you listen to the words, every bit of it's true. And I love that song. It's one of my favorite Beatles songs.
Yeah. I love it.
And he showed up at Apple Studios, ready to record the song. And, Paul and he had been completely like enemies. At this point, and he showed up to the studio and late at night, hoping to be, you know, get some time alone with the record, the, you know, the multi-track machine. And Paul was in the studio, and he played it for him, and it was like old times again. Paul played bass, drums, piano, and sang the amazing signature harmony. You know, the way things are going, yeah. You're gonna crucify me, and you know, the song wouldn't have been the same without him there. And so it just goes to show. But that's about ownership. You know, Trey's always, you know, way, way more friendlier than he has to be there. But you asked about creatively and like how it feels if Trey might chop a bit of a song up. And I have a very easy answer, is that I'm thrilled about it. You know, like back in the, I already mentioned Stash and Chalk Dust. Those two are good examples. Trey grabbed lyrics that I had sent him prior, you know, for this express purpose. And would call me later with the song. And it's just Trey, no Tom. He just has the sheet of lyrics to go by. And he wrote those songs. And there's never been any doubt in my mind who the light bringer in this songwriting right. relationship is. So I've just been incredibly happy to be part of it. So when he calls me up and says, hey, I wrote a song with your words, believe me, I'm excited, honored, and beyond happy.
Terrific.
Yeah, that's really great. And tell us a little bit about like the work ethic. I always describe Trey as he seems like he's hyperactive and he always wants to do something, and you know, he always wants more notes and Mike's always telling him less notes. When he's into it, is he just firing all cylinders, you know, and things are just flying off the top of his head and into the guitar, or do you guys, does it take a while or what?
Oh God, it's exactly that way, but that you described it just now, but even more like, you know, with two turbochargers on, he doesn't sleep. So like there was a time when he was learning guitar, he was already like better than any guitarist I knew. And this is like way back, like 10th grade, he picked up the guitar and could play. But then he like would answer the phone with the guitar and he would play you his answers, you know, as he's talking to you, he'd be playing along. And if he's watching TV, he's got the damn guitar and he's like playing along with the music in the background of the movie or the theme show. He's like that. So yeah, for songwriting sessions, sleep doesn't matter. The work ethic is just like, go. It's just one speed and it's full.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's really fun. What was the movie where they kept showing clips of Trey going, let's just play a little bit. Let's just play a little bit. There was I don't think it was bittersweet, but he's like, oh, let's just play. Let's just play for a little bit. And I was like, all right,
exactly.
Dude,
that's totally. There's no chilling out. It's just that, and it's like, you know, golden retriever or whatever. Like, what's the even like a greyhound? You know, a more skittish dog than a golden. Yeah, golden's more mellow, like a stoned greyhound.
But once you get a greyhound running, you can't stop it.
You can't stop.
That sounds like a good analogy too.
Yes. All right. Well, we'll go with that.
I wanted to just from a fan perspective, like all of us, you know, what we're bringing from this podcast is the fan perspective. Obviously, the three of us, Jonathan, Brad, and I are Phish fans, and we're fans of yours, Tom, as a extended member of the band. I'm curious just to kind of look at it from a fan base perspective and a scene perspective, I guess. Like, what's been your overall kind of experience with the Phish scene as a member and an observer and a member of both, I guess, of the band and of the scene? And are there songs that we should think about differently, like given your perspective on the Phish scene itself? I know I think Birds of a Feather I've read is like sort of, you know, somewhat about the scene, but I'd just be curious about your perspective on being part of both the scene and the band a little bit and what that, how that's affected your songwriting as the scene has blown up.
Right. And if Birds of the Feather is taken to be like a my negative statement about the scene, I hope it's not, because it wasn't really meant that way. I guess it comes off a tiny bit that way, but not really. No, you know, in terms of my experience with the scene, it's been nothing but like phenomenally gracious people and like some of the, you know, most amazing friends I met through the scene. And I just love people, you know, in the audience, they're extremely respectful and friendly. You know, I've had a couple people say, hey, Marshall, your lyrics suck or whatever. But then like, you know, 3 seconds later, their friends will like slap him in the face and he'll turn around and go, I didn't really mean it. I love your, you know, yeah. But,
I got married to Waste.
Oh yeah. Oh God. I get that. Dude, that one happens to be, and I mean, I love hearing it, but you know, I hear it so much and it's incredible. Lots of people out there married to Waste. I hope your marriages are going well. So Birds of a Feather, that one kind of has a scene component. And of course, Down with Disease with 1,000 Barefoot Children Dancing on My Lawn. Apart from that, I don't, you know, nothing really jumps out at me. I write about concepts I'm obsessing on at the time, something I've read or heard or seen. I think I'm bringing the concepts to the audience rather than writing about them. Nice. If that makes sense.
Yep.
Well, that should debunk a few blogs out there.
Exactly.
That's good.
I think there's, people are curious. Yeah, exactly.
I'm debunking and bunking this this interview.
The whole thing, yeah.
We've got it all here. So, Tom, you know, I looked on Wikipedia, of course, because that's what all good interviewers do. And it says it credits you with more than 95 original Phish songs. Do you write with the other band members or for them, or just send them to Trey and Trey kind of lets them sing the lyrics, or how's that work?
So the songs that are credited that have my name and the rest of the band, that's one of those scenarios where my lyrics are like in the room as they've written like a Rogue or something along those lines, or a MoMA dance. In terms of working one-on-one with any of the band members, I think indirectly I've sent Mike lyrics and nothing kind of came from them, and nothing, no blame coming from me. You know, I didn't follow up or whatever. The same thing may have happened with Paige. I believe over, you know, 30 years, lots of combinations and permutations occur. Mm-hmm. Paige and I have talked about writing songs before. We kind of haven't. One-on-one though, Phish, I remember being at Trey's first house, not the one he's in now, and not, well, he sold that one too. Now he's just in New York. But his first Vermont house, Phish and I were there alone, and we wrote, and we we did other things. but
can't imagine.
But we had just some tremendously awful songs, and when Trey showed up, he pressed play and, you know, literally was on his back holding his stomach. I hope that tape is somewhere and will surface at some point. Some of those were hilarious, but I have no idea what the hell they were.
Maybe in the box set, like LP7 in the box
set. Go out and buy LP7 because that's all just Fishman and Tom stoned and writing songs and writhing around in the snow.
That's awesome.
Also includes Ass Handed, I think.
Yeah. That's going to be on the new one, isn't it?
Well, could well be. Yeah, I don't know. All right. Ask Bob Ezrin.
We may know by the time this comes out, actually.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, good point. Good point.
Well, I think, Tom, we don't, you know, we're all huge fans of Trey, and we're so happy that he's where he is. And this podcast is about interviewing you, not about Trey. But I'm just curious from like a best friend perspective, like during those years, just how, you know, if there's any observations from you or lessons from you and kind of how that whole period went, because obviously there was a period where your relationship with him probably changed and his relationship with the band and all of us changed. So I think it is part of the history, but we don't obviously want to dwell on it for too long.
The dark period, kind of?
Yeah.
I mean, anyone who has a friend or family member going through addiction or who went through it, or they know it feels like it's a losing battle with only one inevitable conclusion. Of course, it doesn't have to end that way, and happily many don't, but it can be so incredibly dark. You know, rehab isn't working, friends are getting let down, thoughtless behavior, a consistent struggle to get high and forget or leave behind anything good, no matter how important, to the actual person, you know, the previous person, not the new one who's taken over. But on top of all this, I mean, I had all that, and I don't know how much I should delve into that. He's been very forthcoming with regard to that stuff. But all I can say is, you know, we had the good outcome, and it was hard fucking work on his part and his family's part and friends and everything. And just, I thank, you know, the heavens, whoever there is to thank up there, that it worked out this way. But one thing that happened, and the thing that luckily didn't get left behind, was music. Trey loved writing and recording, you know, even in the darkest state. And so I was up always. I was up for it. And some of these, you know, they got messy or whatever, but everyone still yielded some great music. And I'm really just so happy to have my friend back.
Yeah. Tom, I know that you guys stayed in contact, and it was an interview that we read earlier about, you know, the Backwards Down the Number Line, where that came from. But how much did you have communication with him, and did he have communication with everybody during those 18 months or however long it was?
I don't know how it works with everyone, but I don't know how it could have worked with Trey if he didn't get an apartment there. So he got a place in Saratoga right next to the courtroom, because he basically, part of the agreement that he had with his drug court was all these meetings, and you have to be on time for the meeting. I think it was sort of publicized that the couple times he sort of got on the wrong side of that was because he missed something by 10 minutes or something. Right. You know, so like everything's about keeping your appointments with this kind of program. So your time is regulated, your appointments are regulated. And the idea that, you know, you're kind of leaving behind the old version of yourself. And so I was under the impression, and his father kind of told me that I wasn't entirely correct about it, but I was under the impression that for a while he was unreachable entirely by anyone, and that there was a list perhaps of people that were approved. And I bumped into his father, and this is, you know, well into the program, and I really hadn't talked to Trey, and I thought it was, you know, court mandated, but it wasn't necessarily court mandated, I found out later. But also it was just, you know, it was Trey trying to make a big change in his life mandated, right? So when I finally did reach out, it was because, you know, Trey he didn't have a phone anymore. You know, he had to say goodbye to his entire list, you know, his contact list on his phone. Trey's dad gave me his email. And so I thought I would just give it a shot and sent him that sent him those lyrics. And it was one of those incredible, like, happy moments that reminded me of the 1980s again, where suddenly Trey would be calling with a song on my answering machine, you know, back when we had answering machines. And it was that song. It was Backwards Down the Number Line. And it's a phenomenal version. I think it's on my SoundCloud.
Man, that's heavy. It's so awesome. Yeah. It's so great. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally, totally great. Reached out across the void and found Trey again. And we could still write.
It actually is a defense to me punching people when they bitch about like the ripcord in the number line. Like I actually, yeah. I actually punch them in the nose and then I get arrested and it's a defense.
Yeah, judges go for it though, because how can you not be moved by that story? It's pretty great, and we're all very happy on various levels that you guys were able to reconnect with that. You've spent some time out there on the road with them. I mean, I know for a long time you worked a day job and you were raising your family, but there are also times where you got out and you went to Europe, I believe.
Yeah, back then when the band was like, they had one bus. Now they have, you know, each of them has a family bus. But back then I would call up Trey and there wouldn't be like a decision-making committee or anything back then. It was kind of like, I would say, hey, Trey, can I get on the bus from Hartford to, you know, Philadelphia? And he would go, sure. And it would get on the bus. And I think that's kind of what happened with Europe. Was it 97?
Mm-hmm.
Trey said, hey, we're going to tour in Europe. And I said, holy shit, can I come? Kind of thing. Like, and I think Trey, you know, right away assumed that meant on the bus with them. And thank God, because I you know, had that amazing, beautiful, I think I did both or three tours, two 97s and a 98, if I recall. Mm-hmm. Partially, you know, I wasn't with them the whole time, but I was able to sample a chunk of each of those three tours. And
lovely.
Yeah. Oh, it was phenomenal. Did you want to hear a story about that?
Well,
I guess, I mean, if you're offering.
Now that we're, I mean, because we're all here on the internet, you know, might as well.
Well, it's just, I'd like to describe a little bit about the European scenario, kind of at least my take on the difference of the, you know, the touring in the States versus touring there. Over there, it seemed like the promoters wanted the band to party with them, and they would have, after the shows, they would have really, really cool places for the bands to go, and they were inevitably, you know, an awesome nightclub. And over in Europe, the nightclubs were like just getting started roughly at the time that Phish would be finishing their concert. And you know, I'm not any kind of a dancer, but there I was with the band and anyone who was with the band just writhing in a completely packed, you know, definitely breaking 600 fire code violation nightclub kind of place. And just having the most amazing.
Writhing is amazing.
Writhing, yeah. Seething, thrashing like sharks. Funny thing, like, so the very first time I got over there was in Ireland, and I think they had two shows there. So the second night, someone had the unenviable job of getting like the band and me and some other people from one of those nightclubs onto the bus, because we had to get on a particular ferry to England overnight. And unluckily, some Irish females wound up on the bus with us. And I kind of remember thinking, like, are you sure you want to be on this on this bus? Because we're not going to be, you're not going to wake up where you, you know, got on the bus. That they don't have any idea that they're going to wake up in England and the party's going full tilt. And I have to say that this happened, and I can't even believe it happened. It was raining, and the highways there aren't like ours, which just are straight for 70 miles.
Right.
These go around turns. And some person, and it's a person that you guys might know, but he's going to remain nameless, went out the front party, because the bus had two parties on it, the front and back. And when I say he went out, he went on the roof of the bus, out the skylight, and traveled, and I'm not really sure how, down the roof of the bus and came in the back skylight to the back party. And,
oh man!
It's a death-defying, wow, incredibly stupid thing. But that was sort of the next level of party that we were encountering over there.
It's awesome. It's awesome you guys are partying with James Bond.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the guy had a wingsuit on, so he was cool if he fell off.
Oh, there you go. Back to songwriting here for a second. Is it possible for you to pick a couple of songs, 1, 2, 5, that you're most proud of for whatever reason? Are there some that, you know, they resonate with you and you're most pleased with them? Possibly that changes year to year?
Well, one we already mentioned that doesn't change, and I'm just so proud of Waste. Trey and I wrote it at the Cayman Islands, and it was one of those where we were in the version that we have that appears on Trampled by Lambs and Pecked by the Dove, which is the sessions. The original, very first version of Waste was recorded at the Cayman Islands, and you can hear Trey say, this is going to be, I think the word, it's not cheese. This is going to, something like this is going to be a joke, but let's try it anyway. And he presses record, and we do the version, and we just sing it live because we don't have any overdubbing capability. And it's, the conversation we were having at the time during Waste was we were right on the edge of what you'd call cheese in a way, or I don't know, pop or something. But you got to get close to something to uncover, you know, the magic sometimes. And I think Waste got right there. And, you know, earlier in this interview, you guys had even said about how it's the marriage song.
Mm-hmm.
So for that reason, that people are like electing to have it, you know, commemorate arguably their most important day. I love Waste, and I love it live too. I'll take it anytime, and it never interrupts the flow for me.
is the word you were looking for schmaltz? Is that the word? I love Waste. Well, I'm not knocking the song here.
Yeah. Well, my Yiddish is not so good, but yes, that's the word. So the next song I'll say that I'm proud of is a new one, and it's coming up. It hasn't been played so much this tour, in fact, ooh, if at all, is Shade. And nice. When Trey and I wrote it, we kind of said, this is Waste all grown up.
Mm-hmm.
Because, it really, maybe that's all I need to say about that one. That one's just, it's Waste all grown up. And I can't wait to hear if there's a version of it on the album. We're going to know soon. Funny thing is, the album, what Trey tells me, has like 30 songs vying for 10 slots or something like that. So some songs aren't going to make it that possibly, you know, some people think should. Those might come out in some other way. Who knows? And then, of course, Pebbles and Marbles and Walls of the Cave, both are songs that I wrote respectively for my daughter and my son. Pebbles and Marbles is really kind of one of my favorite Phish songs of all time. And Walls of the Cave as well. I love that one. Trey wrote that. He was on piano, and I was pressing pause and record as he kind of constructed that intro. And we did the same for Vultures, kind of Trey on piano, me on pause record.
Wow. Nice. Cool.
That was my instrument.
That's a really cool Walls, and the Walls intro is, you can totally hear that.
Right.
See that happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for the record, RJ hates Round Room.
That's not true.
I don't know if you guys can be
crazy.
Friends.
Crazy.
We just punched each other.
Yeah. Good. Well, no, I have talked before about how like because I came of age during like the set one closer being Run Like an Antelope or David Bowie or Split Open and Melt, and then, you know, went through the phase of having Walls of the Cave or Pebbles and Marbles close the first set. So
even Zero, yeah.
Exactly. So it kind of like took me a while to adjust. But
have you adjusted?
I think so, yeah. I mean, Walls of the Cave is such a raging song because of the multiple parts that I've gotten used to it. But I think, you know, I'm always, as we all are, like going back to our... We're nostalgic for our roots, I guess.
I've been seeing them longer than you, RJ, and I could go for Pebbles and Marbles any day.
Yes.
But I immediately identified the dad thing with that. You know, I recognized where you were going with that song, and it worked for me.
I'm glad. Some people think, you know, and it works equally well for, you know, it could just be for anyone who inspires you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's great.
Well, let's end on a like light note. Do a couple quick questions for you, Tom. I'll start. You're a noticeable person at a Phish show. If people don't know, you're pretty tall. So
I'm 6'6". Yeah.
6'6", which is
insane. Wow.
Yeah.
Tom towers over me. I'm 6'2". So you're noticeable. I'm sure people say a lot of stuff to you at Phish shows. What's like the funniest thing that you've heard from someone at a Phish show?
It's funny. My wife and I were just actually talking about people saying stuff at Phish shows. She was maybe this will, I'll substitute the answer to be what happens to her. I think she leaves her laminate out and I tend to tuck mine away, the laminate being the like all access backstage pass kind of thing. And she gets, where can I get one of those?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
She says, well, inquiry.
You know, you can marry the songwriter or of Fish. She also has had, can I borrow that? I'll bring it right back.
Honest.
But sort of the most, almost the most outrageous, and I hope in a way the person, and I'm not gonna call her out, the person who's responsible for this behavior knows who she is. But my wife, another thing that happened to my wife, this person was like dancing, like Wook slime dancing all over her, and it's like
writhing, like, Wook writhing.
Yes, miserable dancing and like. You know, total space invasion and, you know, not respecting other person's space, et cetera, et cetera. Turns out this person is like a huge good friend of Fishman's and the band's. And when kind of reintroduced to her as Tom Marshall's wife, she said, "Oh, if I had only known who you were, I wouldn't have done that." And we're like, it's so terrible. Like outrageous, like, you know, there's so much there's so many things that my wife wanted to say, that nothing could come out of her mouth.
Oh, you're not a just,
yeah, if you weren't just an average human, yeah, I wouldn't have been an asshole to you.
Right. I treat people different based on their on who they know.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's hopefully the minority of the fans out there. Yes. Those are good. Those are good.
Yes. So let me ask the next one then. It kind of goes to my earlier question a little bit, but what do you think you get the, what are the songs that you get the most shit for, do you think?
I can narrow it to song. Song. How about what song do I get the most shit for
fair.
Nowadays? Let me just do that one. And it's one you mentioned already. It is backwards down the number line. Nice. But I want to say that the interaction I get from people about it, I would say is 90% love and 10% shit. And they really, when it's shit, they really, really actively come after me. And these are like my best friends. And I think it's like some latent, like, homophobia or something. They're like too worried, too scared that like grown men can express an emotion to each other or something. And it like might, you know, activate some latent, you know, thing in themselves or something. But I'm calling out my friend Liz as the biggest, like, you know, hellbringer when that song comes on.
I guarantee I've got worse friends about that song. They're wrong too.
It's not the lyrics. It's like the abrupt beginning, right?
No. It's the lyrics. People don't want to hear about like a dude whispering in another dude's ear.
That's fine.
Oh man, my response often is, "I'm sorry that you had to listen to your favorite band play one of their favorite songs." You know,
there you go.
Yeah.
All right, Jonathan, as the most active audiophile maybe among us, or music listener, is that what an audiophile is? Anyway. No. Okay. as the person who listens to the, well, I think Jonathan listens to the widest variety of music among the three of us, probably.
He's a variety file.
Variety file. Jonathan, why don't you jump on that last one?
Well, Tom, what else what are you listening to these days aside from Fish?
It's so that question, it's weird. I can't answer it right now because I don't think I am listening to anything. I'm listening to podcasts, honestly. Okay. Like driving my car, I'm listening to podcasts. I will say though that I have this really awesome Radiohead set list, playlist that I exercise to. The song Revelator. I mispronounce it just because I've only read it. I've never heard it. It's amazing. I just sort of worked out to it today. It began my walk. My workout daily is like a 4 mile walk, 5 mile walk.
Cool.
And it's basically either a podcast in my headphones or Radiohead. Nice. And I'm sad to say that I missed their last tour here, but that's not going to happen again.
Yeah, it's weird that you work out by crying, but that's
right. It's a great workout. Yeah. Isn't working out like kidding. Trying to work out your feelings? Isn't that what workout means? Just
requires extra hydration, though.
No, I love to follow up with Jonathan's question. Have you listened to last night's show?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
A couch tour now and then, and usually stay pretty current. I'll check out the set list to see if anything incredibly wacky happened.
Mm-hmm.
I often read people's reviews of it, but this one I haven't listened to, and I'm kind of waiting to listen to it with a pal of mine.
Cool. That's fun. So, Jonathan, follow up with your hard hitter.
Oh, well, gotcha. So you mentioned webcasts, and I posed the what would you ask Tom Marshall question to some folks, and one of them got back with this one. I have to read this to you for Dave. And the question is there a friends and family private webcast that you have access to that possibly even runs when the rest of us people can't have access?
Oh, my God. Well, let me answer that one with a hypothetical. Imagine if there were, do you think that it would be a secret? And do you think that if the person, who had access to it would be allowed to tell if there were one? Just hypothetical.
So the answers are yes and no. So
right.
Amazing. That's a good way to wrap up the discussion. Tom, thanks so much for your time, and thanks for having me in your home with your awesome family and to record this. We really appreciate you taking the time and are so excited about the launch of Under the Scales. I think it's going to be a really unique view into fish culture and fish in general. And I think we're all super excited for you. And thanks so much for coming on this podcast to chat with us.
Oh, gosh. Well, my thanks to you. You're welcome. But really, like I said before, I want to thank you guys. And I'm kind of proud to be, we have gone through a couple fish podcasts. I think you guys are like the third. There were two mm-hmm. others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And those two are gone for various reasons. And I think we're going to be the only two fish podcasts on there. So I'm glad that we're sister casts and not enemy casts.
Yes. The treaty of,
That you won't sign.
No. Just blood. I'll
sign for these guys. It's cool. Thanks so much, Tom, for joining us.
Absolutely.
Really fun. Yeah.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it, Tom.
Thank you, Brad. Thank you, Jonathan.
Yeah.
And thank you, RJ.
All right. Thanks for listening to our interview with Tom Marshall. We're going to leave you with a couple songs. Definitely check out Under the Scales, which will be available on Monday, November 7th. Follow us on Twitter at HFPod, and you can subscribe on iTunes and every other service where you can get podcasts. Send us questions, comments, feedback, and thanks as always for listening. We'll be back within the next week or so with a fall tour recap from this great fall tour of 2016. So everyone enjoy and keep on rocking.
We're going to do a song. I will say one thing here, that Tom and I have been writing songs for since probably like 7th or 8th grade, which was a long time ago for us.
8 years.
Like at least 5 years ago. So a lot of the songs that I played tonight, a lot of the songs that were on the Ghost album and also these new songs were written in, there was 7 days of writing that Tom and I did where we locked ourselves in a farmhouse in Vermont. That's where that song, of course, Farmhouse came. That was the first song of Northern Lights were at, everything. And there's still more songs. It was really a cool time for us. But this one is one that hasn't been played a lot that we wrote at the farmhouse, the same night that we wrote the farmhouse song itself.
Actually, I want to say this is the first night that I've heard a lot of these songs, and actually I have heard some of them over the phone, and they sound a whole lot better.
So I'm here for the first time. So I actually haven't really been wanting to play this one without Tom because we did it together with the harmony. So it's called Sleep. Can't describe the feeling when I'm in my
with a vision blurred. And all my efforts are deterred to reconstruct this image lost. The certain things my mind must do, and even though they're very few, the image glistens like a gem, repairing is not one of them. So I am awake, though in my mind the image that's so unrefined is calling to me from the deep, tempting me to fall asleep.
Drunken mayhem begin.
Oh, I can't cause more to see you. Whispering into his ears. Side to side, my senses slide, avoiding my commands. One by one, they come undone. I fall into your hands.